Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
It's that time of the year when we start taking a look back at the events of the past 12 months. And for the world of science, 2013 turned out to be a busy year.
From spacecraft to gene patents and everything in between, 2013 saw numerous scientific and technological advances, but it also saw concerning news on subjects like climate change and digital privacy.
Joining us now is Steve George. He is the editor-in-chief of Discover magazine, which just published their Year in Science issue. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks, Gene. It's great to be here.
I want to start with kind of the state of science news in general. You know, these days there's a lot of news out there, whether you've got movie stars getting married, you know, princesses having babies. How does science news fare in all of that?
Well, I think it may not be right up there in some people's attention span with royal babies, but I think it's pretty big. You know, last week, Merriam-Webster, the dictionary folks, they announced their word of the year every year based on how many people look it up online. And I wonder if you can guess what this year's word was.
Well, there was the one about the photograph that you take.
Selfie. Yeah,
that was, selfie.
But
science turned out to be a word of the year too, right?
Science was, for Merriam-Webster, it was the word of the year. So, you know, it's been a big year for science or that or... Maybe a lot of kids just got that word on their vocabulary test this year. But it certainly is very much in people's minds, and certainly for the staff here at Discover, you know, we could do the top 100 science stories every day. There's just so much news that's being reported, and in fact, we work on this issue from the middle of the year onward, just trying to identify those stories that certainly are going to be the big stories that will capture lots of folks' attention, but also we try to look at stories that maybe have overlooked, that maybe mainstream media has overlooked, and that may have more far-reaching, sometimes mind-blowing implications than you might see at first glance. And that's one of the reasons why we do the 100 top science stories of each year, which we just did this year with our Jan-Feb issue, which is actually on sale right now.
And it's the one I'm holding in my hand. So let's start with the top science story of the year, according to Discover magazine. And it's the one about the new signs of life on Mars. And I think everybody remembers Curiosity when it was sort of, there was that big question mark there about whether it was going to make the landing or whether it was going to be a disaster. And there was a lot of breath being held while that happened. And I think a lot of people may have forgotten that things happened after Curiosity landed.
I know, right? Yeah, it's funny, when we were looking at this, a lot of people were saying, well, you do know that Curiosity landed in 2012. And I look at it as, well, okay, yeah, in 2012, that's when it showed up for its first day in the office. And it certainly was a big moment. But 2013 was really when Curiosity, got to work. And for us, what was a signal moment that once it was on the ground, it was able to, to use the onboard instruments to find some pretty compelling evidence that the red planet was once habitable. I mean, basically the instruments that Curiosity carries with it, they were able to sample the Martian soil and identify traces of things like carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, basically all the ingredients list that you need for life to exist. And more than that, the rover served as kind of an advanced scout, being able to do some other work, such as being able to determine that future manned missions to Mars, they're probably going to need a little bit more radiation shielding, just based on the radiation readings that the rover was getting. So there was that's just two of just literally. It seemed like every day or every week there was some new findings. So we felt that was really a big moment for 2013 was Curiosity being able to really prove its value and show what it could do. And it's still rolling. It's still doing more work. So we'll be keeping an eye on it, and maybe it'll make it into the 2014 list.
Any idea how long Curiosity is supposed to continue to work?
Well, I think the answer is that it'll work as long as they can can keep it working. You know, what's interesting about so many of these devices is some of them will keep on working. And actually, you know, I know I'd said I'd like to talk about our top 10, and one of the ones that I wanted to talk about, one of my personal favorites, is actually number 6 on our list, which is Voyager 1, which is the probe that I remember launching when I was a kid. And you know, talk about a project which is really still not done. It's now in interstellar space. In 2013, it was officially announced that it has made it out of the solar system and into interstellar space, and it only took 35 years, right? And it still has some functioning instrumentation on it, which is how NASA was able to determine that yes, it finally did clear the solar system. They were able to get some readings from it that show that there was a drop in solar winds, the charged particles that emanate from our sun, and a corresponding jump in galactic cosmic rays from outside the solar system, plus a few other critical readings that they were able to get from still functioning instruments. And remember, this is a device that launched in the 70s, and it's still working. It's still sending data, and now it is officially the furthest human-made object from Earth. So I think it's hard sometimes to say when these things ever end.
Now, that Voyager story really is amazing. I mean, you know, I remember my 1976 Chevy, and suffice it to say, it is no longer with us. And this thing out there, you know, right on the edge of, we don't even know exactly what it's out there on the edge of, and it's still going. And so when you look at Curiosity, when you look at Voyager, every so often people say, why are we bothering to spend money out there? Why does this matter to us here on Earth? And what's your answer to that?
Well, I say you can look at these two right here as prime examples of why this matters. In some ways, some of these experiments, eventually they are going to end. There will come a point where we won't be getting any signals from Voyager, or Curiosity will shut down. But think about it. I mean, for Voyager, over 35 years, Curiosity just landed in 2012, and you know, there's every expectation that we'll continue to get just a tremendous fund of information that certainly in the case of Curiosity is going to help with future missions to Mars, and certainly Voyager, you know, continues to, while as it moves further and further away, there may be less useful information. But I think it's more than just the data. It's the way that that projects like this fire the imagination and make us realize that that there's still more out there for us to learn and experience, even from, you know, from back here on Earth.
Is there the interest? Is there the money for space exploration like there may have been in the past?
Well, you know, I think that obviously we're in a different economy than we were when Voyager launched. But I think that the fact that we're still, for example, talking about a manned mission to Mars. I think there was a point in time where that wasn't even really, you know, considered a realistic option, and it seems to have, you know, waxed and waned over the past few decades. But I would say that, you know, where there's a will, that we will find the way to make it happen.
A little bit closer to home, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled earlier this year that DNA sequences that we all have, of course, cannot be patented. So what is the importance of this? What does it mean for doctors, for researchers, for us?
Yeah, well, so basically what happened here was, as you said, the Supreme Court gave a ruling that invalidates untold numbers of DNA patents held by biotech companies. The ruling basically was that naturally occurring DNA sequences cannot be patented. Just discovering them is not enough to secure a patent. And what this did was it broke a virtual monopoly on certain kinds of genetic testing, and I think most notably for mutations in genes that contribute to breast and ovarian cancer. And these tests cost thousands of dollars, and what's more, these patented genes hampered research efforts because scientists were, in general, shying away from research work that involved using patented genes. So the ruling made a big difference in a couple of ways. I mean, immediately, in fact, the same day that this ruling was handed down in June, other genetic testing companies, which did not hold the patent on these genes, were offering much lower priced genetic tests for breast cancer. And I think more long term, the ruling will have long term implications for conducting research using these genes that were once patented, but now those patents aren't holding up anymore because of this ruling. I think that you'll find researchers will be, you know, more I don't know, I guess for want of a better term, more comfortable working with them, and I think it broadens the potential for research in these areas.
So is this the final word on this sort of patent issue? Are there more aspects to this that we haven't heard of yet?
Well, I think there could be some fallout from it. I think that there will be obviously some question about, well, is this a discovered gene versus this is something that that is invented, something that that in the lab a gene could be modified and could therefore qualify as being something that's invented, and that may well be outside the purview of this ruling, but I think it's something that we're going to have to see. Ultimately, though, gene patents are issued for 20 years, and so they were going to expire anyway. So time itself may end up clearing up any remaining confusion that may result from this ruling.
We're talking to Steve George about the top science stories of 2013, and we'd like to hear from you, too. You can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. Is there a story, a science story, that caught your attention this year? Maybe it's got something to do with stem cells or something to do with technology, like computers or privacy, for example. Give us a call. Let us know what science story you think everyone ought to know about. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can drop us an email at talk@wpr.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're talking with Steve George, the editor-in-chief of Discover Magazine, about some of the top science stories of 2013. And you can join in with yours at 800-642-1234. What is your nomination for the big science story of the past year? You can also post your comments on the Central Time Facebook page. Steve George, before we get to the phones, I wanted to ask you about number three on your list, the CO2 level hitting 400 parts per million. And I have to say, news is such a funny thing because this was one of those stories that sort of came out of nowhere if you're, someone who's non-scientific, and was everywhere for, about a week or so, and yeah, then it just sort of fell off the map again.
Yeah, and I think there's a good reason why. So this was a big story in the spring, the fact that carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gas that most contributes to global warming, had reached a concentration of 400 parts per million in the atmosphere. Now, this was a level that hasn't been seen in thousands of years, so climatologists suppose. So it was touted in the mainstream media as this long-feared milestone. And now, I'm not suggesting that a rising number like this is worth ignoring. It certainly isn't. But among climatologists, 400 parts per million is a bit of a, actually one expert had called it a mile marker on the highway, that something that we've known we were going to hit for a while, but not exactly a sign of the end times. And in fact, what was less reported at the time was that particular 400 parts per million reading dropped shortly afterwards, after it was reported. It was from a sensor in Hawaii, which was was in the northern hemisphere, a place where there's the highest concentrations of CO2. And actually, this number dropped as spring progressed and the growing season emerged, and plants greened up and absorbed more of the CO2. So it was something that it had gone to that level and dropped down, and it's obviously something that we still need to be concerned about, but not as much as, say, if it had been, say, double that. Now, at 800 parts per million, I think it'd be number one on the list, and that would be a story that wouldn't be going away. There'd be no, all ice on land would be melted, oceans would be up about 250 feet, and that's really obviously a number for concern. But yeah, this was one of those milestones that was perhaps not such of a much at the time, and so you're right, it was a blip. It came and it went.
And for some of these stories that have, there's a lot of complexity to all of these stories at some level that we're talking about, and the news media, for better or for worse, often has to simplify things so the people can understand them. But, if people just hear the stories on the news and they're not paying that close attention, do you ever wonder, obviously the aim of your magazine is to try to clarify some of these things, but do you wonder how much people really learn from news media stories? How much they really know about what is really happening with some of these scientific stories?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and it's something that, frankly, we wrestle with every day. I mean, it's something that we strive to make sure that we provide information that that is interesting and even entertaining as far as it goes. But you know, we still try to be true to the information, and we we don't shy away from the complexity. We try to provide a full read as much as we can. But even we have to make sure that we provide that perspective and try to give people as much information as we can, rather than just sort of going with the news ticker, the sort of the little blip of information, if you will. And sometimes you have to do that even with numbers that you want to be true. I mean, for example, number 9 on our list, which was something that was that I paid a lot of attention to. I spent about 20 years as a writer and editor covering medicine and health. But number 9 on our list was the fact that for the first time in 30 years, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had reported a decline in obesity rates in children in 2013. And this number has been going up forever. I mean, it's doubled in adults and tripled in kids over the past 3 decades. So for the CDC to report a decline, even though it's just a small one, is certainly significant. And kids who struggle with obesity are 5 times as likely to be adults who struggle with obesity and all the attendant health complications that come with it, be it diabetes or heart disease or what have you. It's difficult reporting information like that because you don't want people to feel like, oh, okay, well, we finally moved the needle in the right direction. We can stop worrying about, having our kids eating healthy and exercising. And that's the last message that I want to send. Obesity is still a serious issue for this country, and especially for children. And so we wanted to, provide some perspective, still obviously report what was an important piece of news and a very encouraging one. And I thought what was also interesting about this particular report was that the decline didn't appear to be linked to any special program or dietary restrictions. So no crazy diets, no unusual programs, but instead was a result of public health programs promoting the same things you've been hearing all along, eating healthier foods and more physical activity, things that that sound very common sense, but that are still a struggle. So it's important to hit that note that this is still an ongoing issue. It's a problem that has been several decades in the making and will not go away overnight. So it is something that you do have to have that sense of perspective, whether it's talking about a particular mile marker in CO2 levels or even something very positive like this with the decline in obesity rates in kids.
Well, we've got some great listeners lined up. Let's check in with them, and we begin with Douglas, who joins us from Lancaster. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I really hope I'm getting my year correct. It's been a rough year at my house, but I was wondering where this is again one of those complicated issues that probably should be made a little more simple. Where the discovery of the Higgs boson would lie on that list.
Yeah, actually, that was something that in 2012, which was just before my time on Discover, I believe that was number 1 on the list in 2012, but it is still something that that we have continued to look at. But in fact, I believe this year was when they basically had verified, saying yes, it actually has been discovered. As often happens in science news, there'll be a report, and then everyone scrambles to verify or disprove it, as the case may be. So yeah, in 2012, that was when the discovery had been announced. But in fact, we did make a place for the confirmation of the Higgs boson. Actually, I believe we have that. Let me check my notes here. That's number 93 in our top 100. So it still made it into our top 100, and basically was an announcement that it was confirmed that this is the long sought quote unquote God particle that endows all matter with mass. It was in fact number 1 in Discover's 2012 year in science list, but it wasn't actually until this year in 2013 that physicists at the Large Hadron Collider in Europe confirmed that the elusive particle they'd nabbed was in fact It was, in fact, a Higgs. So it still is news in this list, and there'll probably be more news to come in the next year, in 2014, and possibly beyond. That's the great thing about science. You know, it's always in motion. There's always new information, and it's one of the things that's great about working at a place like Discover is we get to, that's our job. We get to report that.
Let's take another call. Mark is with us from Green Bay.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you. I'd like to ask your guest, what were the most interesting stories in mathematics this year?
Oh, in mathematics, which is my specialty. No, it's actually not my specialty.
It's not
at all. I almost feel like I should run down the hall and get Bill Andrews, who is one of our associate editors, and he is our advocate for all things math and physics. And actually, one of the things that was that actually was fairly high on our list, and maybe our listener Mark here knows more about this than me, which is the we put it at number 7 on our list for a very good reason. Number 7 being a prime number, but this year actually in 2013 there were two mathematicians working in completely different locations. One in France and one in my home state of New Hampshire, in fact, on dealing with the so-called twin primes conjecture. And Mark, I don't know if you know more about it than me. You want to talk about it? Is this something that you had followed when it hit the news?
I'm just an amateur. You know, I read this story the best I can. But I have, I don't know that particular conjecture. No.
Well, so here's the deal. So we all know what prime numbers are. Basically, they're the numbers that are divisible only by one in itself. And in mathematics, there's this thing known as the twin prime conjecture, which states that there are an infinite number of primes that, for example, differ by two, like 5 and 7. And the twin prime conjecture is famous. Well, it's famous among mathematicians anyway. But it was something that that hadn't been proved. And so it's one of these things that that these two mathematicians, one Yiteng Zhang of the University of New Hampshire. Now, he made a serious dent in this conjecture. As often happens in these cases, there's never a complete and full proof, so it still leaves us something to report next year or the year after.
And, Steve, I'm going to have to stop you because, the clock is not abstract at all.
No, it's not.
It just keeps ticking and ticking and ticking. So we'll let people get the latest copy of Discover, and they can read all about it for themselves. Thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, thanks so much.
Steve George has been with us. He is the editor-in-chief of Discover Magazine, which is based right here in Wisconsin, by the way.